We can't simply conflate the Democratic and Republican Party. I think it insults at this point the intelligence of people who live on the knife's edge, who have experienced the differences in policies in the last 3 years compared to previous years in the 1990s, to say, oh, what the heck, Democrats, Republicans, all the same. Our solutions involve building coalitions for the long term so that as independent social forces and movements, we're going to be around next year and next year and next year, no matter who's in the White House come January 20th, 2005, to raise hell and organize and pursue the kind of politics that we believe in. That's where we are. That's our possibilities. We need to know how to oust the right wing, be part of that process, take part in the historic responsibility of the left to fight the far right, to beat back the far right, and also build social movements that have their ears to the ground, that aren't building some kind of vanguard party, that are interested more in movement building than narrow sectarian party building.
I want to thank Howard Zinn for sending a message. He's a person who's made enormous contribution in many movements and in written excellent materials. First, let me just say that Matt Gonzalez, just 1 week ago, made it clear on the radio that he will support and vote for the candidate of the Green Party. So let's not try to use Matt Gonzalez against the Green Party. He's one of the greatest people we have. And I think in San Francisco, we saw for the first time what I know to be true, that the people of America would vote for an alternative party, for a third party, if the framework was allowed and free elections were allowed. And San Francisco is a symbol always. What happens in San Francisco happens in the rest of the nation 10 years later. And what you saw there was a rebellion of the Democrats against their own party. And they brought everybody to San Francisco except Harry S. Truman to back their Democrat, who, by the way, gave money to George Bush in his campaign of 2000 and was on their voter slate. And everything about a third party running is this. The voters make the decision, not the party, not the candidate. The fact Ralph Nader runs doesn't stop Norman from convincing many people here to vote Democrat, and you're going to go vote Democrat, and that's your right. But what he's asking is that's not enough for him. He doesn't want the people who disagree with him to have a choice, to be able to cast a vote. That is so obviously anti-democratic. Why there's people in this audience right now that will never vote for a Democrat, period. They have passed the line. They have drawn the land in the sand. They say we are not voting for the corporations to dominate us and for those who support George Bush. And I tell you and I repeat it, a
strong Green campaign
will hurt Bush much more than if we didn't run.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for thanking me.
The next question is from Phyllis Bennis from the Institute of Policy Studies in Washington, D.C.
I voted for Ralph Nader in 2000 because we were long overdue for a challenge to the domination of two corporate-controlled war parties. And the differences then between the evil and the greater evil were simply too small to make voting for the lesser evil acceptable. But this time around, things are way different, not because the Democrats are much better, but because the Republicans under the Bush ideologues now in power are vastly worse, even than we anticipated. 4 more years of consolidating this drive towards empire, this insatiable greed, this escalating repression at home, and this dismissal of U.S., let alone global, public opinion is simply too dangerous to risk. How do you both assess the current risk of 4 more years of the Bush administration and the consequences of its consolidation of power? And how do you think a green presidential bid might challenge that?
We turn to Peter, and please, Peter, 90 seconds.
Sure. We need to have one candidate who runs against Bush and against what he's done. And people have illusions that the Democratic would do this. How could a party that has voted and supported him on every single major issue be an instrument to oppose him? Our existence and our fighting and our making our statements on television, wherever we can reach people. 7 million Democrats voted for George Bush last time. 200,000 of them in Florida voted for George Bush. The fact is the Democrats concede the premises to George Bush and then argue about how it should be done. That's all they do. If we silence the Green, we silence the only voice that's really against George Bush. And I'm sorry that you see it that way. You see, there's a myth here. that the Democratic Republican Party and George Bush is this little, there was a coup, the little group has taken over. Have you ever watched CNBC or Fox or CNN? Do you see how they treat George Bush? Here's a guy who can't say four sentences and still be speaking English. And they all back him like he's the greatest thing since sliced bread. The people who have the power in America are behind Bush. This is not some accident. And the Democratic Party plays right into it.
Well, it's a very clear question. Does it matter whether Bush gets another 4 years in the White House or not? I think it matters. Most people on the left think now clearly that it matters. Running Nader for president, it's not a question of some therapeutic benefit for us to feel like we're venting our anger. It's about a strategy. And I really think that there's a red herring floating around about somehow we're trying to deny people's rights to vote for someone. Sure, Ralph Nader has a right to run for president. People have a right to do a lot of things. There is something called strategy. There is something called devoting your resources in a way that is tactical, that is strategic, and leads you where you want to go. One of the places, I think the prime place that progressives and many others in this country and certainly people around the world want to go is to escort Bush out of the White House on January 20th next year. That is clear. So why do we keep eliding that question? Why do we keep, from some in the Green Party leadership, keep hearing this notion that, gee, we really don't like Bush, but we don't like the Democrats either, and then it gets very fuzzy about whether or how important it is to get Bush out of the White House next year. It's clear that the consequences, and this goes to Phyllis's question from Phyllis Bennis, the consequences of 4 more years in the White House from the George W. Bush administration are such that we want to foreclose that possibility. There are such things in history as tactical coalitions, as tactical alliances. We have histories of the left being sectarian, pursuing narrow organizational party agendas, and enabling the right to consolidate their hold on power. We don't want another 4 years of Ashcroft in the Justice Department. We don't want four
Thank
more
you,
years
Norman.
Of this administration, period.
We continue now the question and answer segment of this evening's debate with Norman Solomon and Peter Camejo, turning to a question from Ralph Nader.
Given your wide knowledge of civic and political movements and your commitment for civil liberties inside the electoral arena, what are the various benefits to a Nader presidential run this year?
We begin with Norman Solomon.
Yeah, I wish I could fill my answer with all kinds of glowing anticipation for the benefits of Ralph running this year. I don't see very many. I see them dwarfed by the downsides. I would love to see Ralph Nader out there every day doing what only he can do, which is draw on 40 years of leadership, not only on consumer rights, but a whole range of issues. Let's amplify his voice, but let's not give people a choice only of you only hear Ralph if he's running for president. I want to hear Ralph whether he's running for president or not. He doesn't need to do it this year. The counterproductive aspects of running, I think, far outweigh the benefits. And I'm sure there's some benefits, frankly, I can't think of any worth mentioning right now. This year, unlike 4 and 8 years ago when I supported him running.
Thank you. Peter Camejo, go ahead.
Ralph Nader is a legend in his own time. There has been no greater citizen in the history of the United States for the last 40 years in attempting to defend the people of this nation against corporate crime and abuse. But the greatest thing Ralph Nader ever did was when he finally stood up and said the Democratic and Republican Party are the problem. They represent the corporations and they play a game on the people. People think they're choosing somebody else when they vote for the other party. When the same people donate to both and the same people run both. And they will do both. It was the Democrats that took us to Vietnam and killed 2 million people. Could Ralph be a help? Ralph would be an enormous help. Right now, Bush is showing weakness in the polls. We need Ralph out there. And he's not going to get the media unless he's running for president. That's a fact. I talked to 20 million people in the debates in the recall election. How many people would I have reached if I didn't run, no matter what the dangers were of what the result would be? We must not be silenced. The truth has to be heard. What Nader will do is let the American people begin to understand the crime that is being committed by the Democrats and Republicans, unified behind George Bush. They have voted for him, supported him, stand up for him, and he must go. George Bush is a problem. We must get rid of him, and Ralph Nader running is going to be a huge help to win people over against George Bush.
Yeah, I keep waiting. I keep trying to hear some plausible scenario for how...
Norman.
Am I answering a question here?
You already did.
Oh, gosh. Okay. Sorry about that. Consider that my over-the-bell spell there.
You did finish early, so I guess we can tack it
on. Well, that's cool. Let's go ahead.
But let's keep to the format or our chaos will reign. Okay, so we asked Kevin Danaher, the co-founder of Global Exchange and the prolific author and editor, to contribute a question. And we love Kevin at Left Coast Radio. He didn't want to do it the way all the others wanted to do it. And those of you who know him certainly are not surprised by that. He wanted to ask you each your own individualized question. So we said sure. So the first question we'll go to is Kevin Danaher's question to Norman Solomon, and we will have Norman and Peter each respond to that question. Then we'll have Kevin Danaher's question to Peter Camejo and have Peter respond and then Norman respond to that. A little bit different now. So here we go with Kevin Danaher's question to Norman Solomon.
First, I want to preface my questions by saying that I'm personal friends with both Norman and Peter, so if this sounds barbed and pointed, there's no malice intended, but I want to make this as sharp as I can. First, for Norman, I think the question of, oh, the Greens shouldn't run somebody, it ignores how the rules work. The way the rules work is you've got to run a candidate or else you're not on the ballot next time. But the question I have for Norman is, Norman, if the Greens shouldn't run a presidential candidate this time, well, when can we create a non-corporate party? Are we just forever going to be reduced to choosing between the moderate pro-corporate candidate and the far-right corporate candidate? At some point, the movement in this country has to have an alternative to the corporate parties. If not now, when? And if not us, who?
Well, part of the answer hinges on how important we think it is to get rid of George Bush in the White House. I think there's a real difference between ideological evangelism and strategic political organizing with a strategy. I mean, there's a difference between having a vision only and also being capable of hearing, understanding what the objective conditions are now, what's going on in the country, understanding where people are at. We need to go ahead and create a non-corporate party. I would argue that we can do so by, as I said, building that foundation before getting fixated time after time on this presidential campaign, which this time around would be counterproductive, as I've argued. If not now, when are we going to stop the right-wing juggernaut of George W. Bush and Cheney and Wolfowitz and Rumsfeld, the neocon extremists? When, if not now, are we going to put a stop to their control over the executive branch of this government? If not now, when indeed? And if not us, who will combine fighting the far right with building a strong progressive movement, if not us, then who indeed?
Peter, your response.
Norman's position is the same position that was taken against the abolitionists. You shouldn't run. The Whigs are much better on the issue of slavery than the Democrats. They're totally run by the slave owners. The populace would never have run. In fact, what Norman is arguing here is the same argument we've had for 100 years. It's never the time to stand up and tell the truth against them. It's always, well, now it's Bush. Yes, Bush is horrible. You think Ronald Reagan was nice? You know, you think LBJ was nice? What were you going to say then? We got to vote Republican? The thing is, the whole issue is posed wrong. It's not a question of falling for what they set up for us. They know they have to have two parties because if they only had one, the people would want an alternative. The job as the Democrats is to prevent any alternative to have. Imagine the effectiveness of this system, which doesn't allow people to vote green and then the runoff vote for the Democrat, but they can express their point of view. They get the progressives like all of us here fighting each other. Think how great this is. They can get Norman out telling the Greens not to run, and they don't even have to pay him. He'll do it for free. This is an incredible system. We have to break with it and stand up for what we believe.
We don't have to have, you know.
Now it's time to go to Kevin Danaher's question to Peter Kamejo.
For Peter, I want to go back and revisit that rap that the Democrats did on us when Gore lost. And they blamed it on the Greens. Oh, Nader cost us the election. And, of course, we resisted that and said, no, no, that's not true. But what about if we turned that around and said, yes, we did cost you the election. And we'll do it again, damn it, if you don't treat us as equals. And assuming that the Democratic candidate comes to the Green Party and says, let's talk. I want Peter to answer the question. And don't, you know, wiggle out of it by saying, oh, that won't happen. I'm posing a hypothetical. If Dean or whoever the Democratic Party candidate is who wins the nomination comes to the Green Party leadership and says, okay, let's work out some kind of a quote-unquote deal here, what is it that we ask? What is our position? Do we want EPA, Labor, and Interior Department? What is it that we want as a Green Party? That's my question to Peter.
Kevin is one of my most favorite people. He's extremely bright, and he is what he has done in his life has just been fantastic, him and Medea Benjamin both. And I hope we can talk Kevin into being a candidate for the Green Party at some level, because I think he'd make a fantastic candidate. Our goal is not to spoil. We're opposed to spoilership. And the Greens have to be very principled and clear on this. We do not. That's not why we run. That's why the Democrats and Republicans keep the law it is, to turn hostility to us, especially if we start growing. I have talked, he says, go talk to the Democrats. I've talked to every leading Democrat that we have in California. I've asked them, why do you do this? Why don't you try democracy? Try having free elections like they do all over the world. It's tough. They see why. Look what's happening here. Understand what the nation has done. That's why they don't allow free elections. It knows it'll prevent an opposition from ever developing that can really represent the people. As far as negotiating people in our vote, we can't do that. The Green Party is a totally different culture. We respect the people who vote for us. We would never go to another candidate, at least I would never do this, go to another candidate and said, if you agree to these three things, then we will tell our people to vote for you. No, we don't buy and sell the votes of supporters of the Green Party. We are building a totally different culture with enormous respect for the people, and that it's their will that has to be respected, and their votes have to be respected. No negotiating, especially nothing secret.
Thank you, Peter. Norman, your response.
Yeah, I'm against secret negotiations, too. I would like to answer the question from a slightly different angle in the form of quoting a recent statement by Joel Covell, who's a former Green Party candidate for senator in New York. This is what Joel Covell had to say. Quote, tens of millions of people, including a lot of radicals, believe that Bush's men are moving to rip up the Constitution and fundamentally restructure the American Republic to destroy the slim chance of democratic renewal upon which green electoral politics, along with much else, rests. And then Covell goes on to say, and again I quote, these are qualitative shifts, the way quantitative changes become qualitative after a while, then create new configurations. It is very weak reasoning to point out how awful the Democrats are, how corporate, etc., and neglect to realize that a rogue faction of the ruling class, represented by the Bushies, can break loose even from the traditional Republican Party and set out to change the fundamental structures themselves. That is how republics can turn into dictatorships. Will it happen? Well, I don't know. Nobody does. Is it more likely now than ever before? Yes, yes, and will become even more so if Bush gets in again, unquote. I'm still waiting for an explanation of how Ralph Nader or another Green Party candidate running for president this year will help us get George W. Bush out of the White House. I'm still waiting.
You're listening to a debate between Norman Solomon and Peter Kamejo, live from the Quest Theater in Sacramento.
You've been listening to audio from a January 29th debate between Peter Camejo and Norman Solomon that took place in Sacramento, California. The debate was organized by community radio station KVMR. And you're listening to Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR Knoxville. Now it's time for our weekly installment of readings from Disciplined Minds, a critical look at salaried professionals and the soul-battering system that shapes their lives by Jeff Schmidt, published in the year 2000. In the chapter we're going to begin today, chapter 11, titled Gratuitous Bias, Schmidt looks generally at the various standardized tests that students must now take and pass at various levels of the educational process before even entering college or graduate school. Schmidt writes, "Standardized multiple-choice tests should not escape scrutiny in a book about the production of professionals. Some such tests are nothing less than professional qualifying examinations. The medical college admission test, for example. Others, such as the graduate record examination, serve as graduate school admission tests for fields that do their professional training in graduate school. Still others, such as the scholastic assessment tests, formerly known as the scholastic aptitude test, make an early cut at the point of college admission. Extending this book's approach to these objectively graded qualifying tests exposes the political origin of their cultural bias and shows the bias to be less superficial than most critics of the standardized tests realize. Critics of standardized examinations say that the tests favor middle-class, white, and male students over working-class, minority, and female students. Their main target is the Educational Testing Service, the company that produces the SAT, which each year assesses the college qualifications of 2 million high school students, and the GRE, which each year assesses the graduate school qualifications of nearly 400,000 college students and others. The critics have embarrassed ETS and other test makers by publicizing examination questions whose biases with respect to class, race, or gender are obvious. Questions requiring familiarity with activities such as polo, sailing, horseback riding, tennis, and golf, and with words such as regatta, pirouette, and minuet. Questions based on reading passages that never mention minorities. Questions that refer to men more than women. Test makers have responded by changing the look of their tests. Today, tests such as the SAT and the GRE may still look difficult in places, but they do not look biased. In fact, the tests look very liberal, seeming to bend over backwards for the disadvantaged student. References to middle-class recreational activities have disappeared, as have disproportionate references to men. Students now read passages about poor minority women. One SAT, for example, featured a reading passage on the role of women in the changing lifestyles of Mexican-American migrant families. ETS makes sure that every edition of the SAT has a reading question about minorities. Thus, students have read about African-American artisans in pre-industrial America, African-American artists today, the civil rights movement, blacks reclaiming their ancestry, Chinese scientific achievements, the worldview of the Navajo, industry in Puerto Rico, black soldiers in the Union Army, and the black art movement. ETS now subjects each question to a sensitivity review to eliminate terminology that would offend any ethnic or gender group, and a differential item functioning review to make sure that minorities and whites and women and men whose scores match on the test as a whole, would also score equally well on the question under scrutiny. This ensures that no question is more biased or differently biased than the test as a whole. These changes are not evidence of substantial bias, say the testers, just fine-tuning. The test makers take the position that the tests weren't biased in the first place, and obviously aren't biased now. This position is consistent with the fact that the changes have had no substantial effect on the scores of women, minorities, low-income students, or any other group. Lower scores reflect deficiencies in education, say the testers, not bias in testing. Despite the reforms and the arguments of the test makers, critics have a gut feeling that the tests are still unfair. They see disadvantaged students who are clearly capable of learning, but who are barred from many colleges and scholarships because of low test scores. Common sense tells the critics that the tests are not neutral in this process. In the absence of fundamental understanding of the problem, some critics have adopted the strategy of finding and exposing as many imperfections in testing as possible. But until the critics offer a clear, sharp analysis of why the selection examinations are biased and where the bias resides in the examinations, the enterprise of selecting and rejecting people through standardized examinations will continue to be seen as a legitimate social practice. The key to the required analysis is to see the tests not as a flaw in a nonpartisan system of college admission, but as a logical part of a larger system of college admission, college education, and employment that itself needs to be criticized. Those who dare to do this will be labeled radicals, but their broader perspective will quickly give them clear insight into long-standing testing issues that are otherwise impossible to resolve. Here, I will look at the tests as part of a larger system and use the view to explain why test questions that are biased on their face appeared on the examination in the first place, why their removal has not affected scores, and where the bias resides in the tests. And I'm reading from Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul-Battering System That Shapes Their Lives by Jeff Schmidt, published in the year 2000. Going on with the next subsection of Chapter 11, titled Bias, Necessary and Unnecessary, Hidden and Superficial. The advertised goal of college admissions examinations is to estimate how well individuals will do in college. While some critics argue that the tests should be abolished because they often fail to meet this goal, I argue that they should be abolished because they often succeed. Admission examinations are an instrument of bias even when they accurately estimate the degree to which individuals have what it takes to succeed in college, because the colleges themselves are biased. The mainstream educational institutions are biased toward reproducing the present social structure, so that middle-class, white, and male-gendered attitudes, values, outlooks, and approaches to problems spell success in college, while working-class, minority, and female-gendered perspectives do not. The main educational mission of the colleges in any country is to produce people to staff and perpetuate that country's social and economic system. And so it is no accident that the same attitude and values that are key to success in college are the key to success in jobs that require a college degree. The student whose middle-class values make college something of a party is likely to advance faster on the job after graduation than the student whose working-class values make college an arduous experience in an alien world, even though the latter student works harder than the former. The favored outlook, which best serves the interest of the establishment, is by no means universal or easy to teach. colleges can fine-tune the values and attitudes of students. But as large impersonal institutions with thousands or tens of thousands of students, they cannot give enough individual attention to carry out major transformations. They fulfill their mission mainly by admitting those with the right attitude and values, and by rejecting those who would require a major reorientation to become good servants of the system. The colleges deal with incorrect admissions less through the difficult and costly process of transforming attitudes and values than through simple disposal. The college dropout rate is about 50%. To minimize their mistakes, colleges use admissions tests that favor students who have the attitude and values that are the key to success in college and in jobs that require a college degree. Because of the orientation of the colleges and the nature of the larger social hierarchy, these attitudes and values are more likely to be held by middle-class students than by working-class students, by whites more than by minorities, by men more than by women. Hence, any test that works in predicting success in college necessarily favors middle-class white and male students, because those students are more likely to have the attitude and values that spell success. Such favoritism is not the purpose of the tests. It is just a sign that the tests are doing a good job of selecting the people best suited to staff and perpetuate the social and economic system. With this understanding, one need not make special arguments to explain why the tests, the colleges, and the system as a whole also welcome those working-class, minority, and female students who, through cultural self-denial, the assumption of alien values or other adjustments, have the attitude and values, the style of thinking and approach to problems, the general orientation and outlook that allow them to serve the system well. If the job of the college entrance examination is to select the people who will best serve the system, then these tests have no need for questions on which middle-class, white, or male students do better than working-class, minority, or female students who are equally prepared to help maintain the social structure. Nevertheless, a few questions with such gratuitous biases have appeared on college admissions examinations. To understand why, one must first understand the kinds of bias that an examination can carry and the ways in which it can carry that bias. An examination can carry basically two kinds of bias: unnecessary bias, which the examination does not need to achieve its actual social goal, and necessary bias, which the examination must have to achieve its actual social goal. A test that aims to rate people according to their knowledge of grammar, for example, needs a bias in favor of those who know grammar and against those who do not. But it does not need a special bias against, say, people who vote for Democrats, people who don't know how an oscilloscope works, or any other group. The test has no need for, say, Northeasterners to outscore residents of Appalachia who know grammar equally well. Similarly, to achieve their goal, college entrance examinations need a bias in favor of those who are likely to serve the system well and against those who are unlikely to do so. But these tests do not need a special bias against working-class, minority, or female students. The necessary bias by itself screens out those working-class, minority, and female students who are unlikely to become good servants of the system. An examination can carry bias in basically two ways: in its superficial content, which includes the topics of the questions and the vocabulary used, and in its hidden content, which includes the context, form, or structure of the examination and its questions. A look at some examples will help clarify the crucial distinction between a question's superficial content and its hidden content. and will illustrate how these two levels of content carry unnecessary and necessary biases. Here are a couple of questions from the SAT. Okay, now these are questions of analogy, and they show you bridle is to horse as A, bone is to dog, B, olive branch is to dove, C, valor is to soldier, D, precept is to conduct, E, devotion is to duty. And another example, pirouette is to dancer, as touchdown is to referee, or motivation to coach, somersault to acrobat, model to sculptor, rink to skater. An examination's superficial content can produce both necessary and unnecessary bias. Hence the words bridle and pirouette, which are part of the superficial content of the questions, help produce the test's necessary bias to the extent, if any, that students familiar with them are more willing and able than others to serve the system, and therefore are more likely than others to do well in college. Sorting out students in this way is a goal of the test. The same two words produce an unnecessary bias to the extent, if any, that they are not equally familiar to students who are from different social groups, but who are nevertheless equally willing and able to serve the system, and who are therefore equally likely to do well in college. Sorting out students in this way is not a goal of the test. The rest of the bias in an examination comes from the hidden content of the test and its questions. Consider the examples that I've just read to you. They are isolated word puzzles. They must be answered quickly. They test aptitude. They test within the social framework of the status quo, and so on. As the previous chapter explains, this sort of hidden content is biased in favor of those willing and able to carry out assignments for the system, and against those whose orientation leaves them unprepared to serve. Here, the hidden content produces necessary bias, that is, bias that helps the examination achieve its goal. Test makers, such as ETS, check out each examination question for biases by using a mathematical technique known as the Mantel-Hansel method for the measurement of differential item functioning. This technique does not identify a college admissions test question as biased just because, say, a much smaller percentage of black students than white students picks the wanted answer. For black students, on the average, might not be equally prepared to do well in college. A test item is said to function differently for blacks and whites only if blacks and whites whose scores match on the test as a whole do not score equally well on the item. The underlying philosophy is that blacks who would do as well in college as whites, as indicated by their identical scores on the test as a whole, should score as well as whites on the question. Hence, this method flags only questions that have an unusual amount of unnecessary bias, or that have a bias against different social groups than those the test as a whole is biased against. More precisely, the method can identify particular questions that have more or less than the average amount of unnecessary bias against a particular group, but it cannot detect bias that pervades the test. What the test makers find when they use the Mantel-Hansel method to check for biases against particular social groups tells us something about how large a role such unnecessary biases play in college entrance examinations. A test's superficial content varies a lot from question to question as words and topics change, but the test's hidden content stays more or less the same from one question to the next. Therefore, if the test is biased against a particular social group, and if the questions carry much of this bias in their superficial content, then one would expect to see a lot of question-to-question variation in the amount of bias against the group. It is just such a variation that the Mantel-Hansel method is capable of detecting, and the only thing that the method is capable of detecting. However, the test maker's application of the method to various social groups has shown there is, in fact, not much question-to-question variation in the unnecessary biases. This implies that there is not much unnecessary bias in the superficial content of the questions. And the previous chapter's detailed analysis of the hidden content of test questions found only necessary bias. So, the test simply does not have much unnecessary bias. The test bias is mainly what is necessary for it to accomplish its goals. In the case of the SAT, this necessary bias favors those who are the most promising from the establishment's point of view. The most promising college students, the most promising future staffers of the system. This bias accounts for the low test scores of various social groups, whose members clearly have the aptitude for further learning, but not the attitude and values that would make them good servants of the present social structure. The SAT would more properly be called the Scholastic Attitude Test, and is little more than a system service examination. The small amount of unnecessary bias that standardized college entrance examinations do have tends to be quite visible. Through their application of the Mantel-Hansel method, test makers have, in a sense, proved mathematically that any unnecessary biases in these tests reside in the superficial content of the questions. According to an ETS spokesman, when you look at the questions that this technique consigns to the trash heap, the source of the bias is usually quite obvious. Meaning that the unnecessary bias is in the superficial content of the questions. This doesn't imply that all the bias in the superficial content is unnecessary, just that the unnecessary bias is in the superficial content. Meanwhile, the test's necessary bias is carried more in its hidden content than in its superficial content, in the form rather than the face of its questions. Even if the test were made up exclusively of questions whose superficial topics were working people, minorities, and women, middle-class white males would still get the highest scores, as they do now on such questions. In any case, an admissions or qualifying examination's necessary bias in favor of those who would best serve the system is certainly its main bias, and as such, it accounts almost completely for the score differentials that are often thought to be the result of class, race, and gender biases. Although questions with unnecessary bias play an insignificant role in producing these score differentials, they've received a great deal of attention because they are so easy to spot. One can understand the origin of these questions and the reason that their unnecessary, very visible biases usually favor the same groups that the test's necessary bias favors, middle-class, white, male students, by looking at how examination questions are written. And I'm reading from Disciplined Minds. A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul-Battering System That Shapes Their Lives by Jeff Schmidt, published in the year 2000. Going on to the next subsection of Chapter 11, titled Freudian Slips. There are mathematical methods for determining how well a college admissions examination does its job of predicting success in college. One can compare test scores and college grades, for example, but there is no formula for writing the examination that will do the best job. The most that question writers can do is maintain a mental image of a student who does well in college and dream up questions that will be more difficult for other students than for this student. The more accurate the writer's mental image of the kind of student that their clients, the colleges, want, the better they will do at writing questions that favor such students. The goal of today's liberal admissions or qualifying examination is to offer all students, rich and poor, majority and minority, male and female, an equal opportunity to serve the system. But the question writer's image of the student set for success in college is probably that of a middle-class white male, not because the question writer is prejudiced, but because such a student is the most likely to succeed. It is inevitable that the question writers working with this mental image will from time to time take a cheap shot and write a question whose superficial content gives an unnecessary advantage to middle-class white or male students. However, the resulting scattered, gratuitous biases against poor, minority, and female students cannot account for the significantly lower scores of these students on the test as a whole. It is the systemic bias in favor of those best prepared to serve the status quo that accounts for the scores. If the cheap shots are important, it is because they are Freudian slips by question writers, and like such slips in general, are embarrassing because they are revealing. In this case, revealing of the tester's mental image of the typical student that colleges seek. The Educational Testing Service inadvertently drew my attention to one of their Freudian slips, one showing that they consciously adjust which groups of people their tests favor. They must make such adjustments, of course, to meet the changing recruitment priorities of their clients, the colleges. The example illustrates the historic change from the old recruitment regime, which, among its other biases, simply favored men, to the present regime, which favors anyone with male-gendered values. When I phoned the giant gatekeeping organization to see what they would tell me about their test bias, they put me in touch with one of their principal measurement specialists, Michael J. Zeike. Yes, Zeike, said ETS, often finds bias in proposed test items and does its best to root it out. The example he chose to give me was that women get lower scores than men on questions about war and on questions about geometry. A few days after I spoke with Zeike, a couple of ETS booklets he had promised to send arrived in the mail. As I read about the testing behemoth's sensitivity to women, I was startled to come across this, quote, "Where a question in a mathematics test might once have mentioned Mary Smith's calculations for roasting a turkey, a similar question today might mention her calculations for establishing missile trajectories," close quote. Missile trajectories, a masterful combination of war and geometry. This choice of context, surely made unknowingly, blurts out the tester's male-gendered view of expanded opportunity for women, as suggested by the question's original formulation in terms of turkey roasting, which put the woman in a stereotypical kitchen role. Question writers of the old regime favored men. As suggested by the question's new context, today's question writers favor anyone who has a male-gendered orientation and who is therefore advantageously positioned to succeed in college today. The actions of the test makers show that they understood thoroughly the different kinds of bias and different levels of content discussed here. They know full well that the visible biases, which in the past proved very costly in terms of public relations and threatened the entire testing enterprise, are in fact unnecessary and can be dropped. Or better yet, freely manipulated to make the test appear to favor the disadvantaged without affecting scores. The resulting questions that appear to favor working people, minorities, and women are most easily answered by middle-class white males because these questions have a more fundamental bias, a bias towards those with the attitude and values that the system seeks. By reversing the unnecessary biases in the superficial content of the tests, liberal psychometricians have done little more than put an egalitarian face on an instrument of pro-system bias. They've worked hard to make this superficial change, but they have worked even harder to prevent examination reform from going beyond it. Professional question writers certainly know which social groups are most likely to do well on the tests that they help construct, but that is not what makes them good question writers. They are good at their job of coming up with just the right questions because they have an intuitive feeling for the values, attitude, outlook, and approach that the tests favor. They have internalized the spirit of the tests. Because they have made the spirit of the tests their own, they are likely on occasion to gild the lily and come up with questions whose superficial content carries the very same bias that the test as a whole carries. A look at some examples is informative and entertaining, but one must remember not to overestimate the importance of biases that are visible in the superficial content of test questions. Apparently, whoever wrote the following GRE analytical ability questions understands, perhaps subconsciously, that one characteristic of students who are promising from the system's point of view is a willingness and ability to comply with bureaucracies rather than fight them. As with all the examples that I present, to understand the argument fully, the reader should actually write down answers before proceeding. Okay, well, this is a radio program, and you're not going to be able to do that. But I'm going to give you a brief sense of this question, of the flavor of it. This is a series of questions, such as, to apply to college, a student must see the school counselor, obtain a transcript at the transcript office, and obtain a recommendation from teacher A or teacher B. A student must see the counselor before obtaining a transcript. The counselor is available only Friday mornings and Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday afternoons. The transcript office is open only Tuesday and Wednesday mornings, Thursday afternoons, and Friday mornings. Teacher A is available only Monday and Wednesday mornings. Teacher B is available only Monday afternoons and Friday mornings. Maria, a student, has already seen the counselor and does not care from which teacher she obtains her recommendation. Which of the following is a complete and accurate list of days when she could possibly complete the application process in one day? And it goes on asking for different permutations on that. Another series of questions. You cannot enter unless you have a red ticket. If you present a blue form signed by the director, you will receive a red ticket. The director will sign and give you a blue form only if you surrender your yellow pass to him. If you have a green slip, you can exchange it for a yellow pass, but you can do so only if you have a blue form signed by the director, etc. And Schmidt continues, anyone attempting to impose an admission system like the one above, say at a rock concert, would discover very quickly that different individuals respond in different ways to systems of bureaucratic control. Yes, some people would spend their time focused on the rules, analyzing and reanalyzing them, trying to figure out what they are supposed to do. Others, however, would simply present whatever documents they have and demand to be let in. Yet others would take a glance at the rules and storm the gate. An individual's tendency to submit to bureaucratic control or to fight it, or to do some of each, reflects the individual's attitude about how to deal with power, a political attitude. To many of us, a decision to storm the gate would show more analytical ability than would a decision to submit to an oppressive level of bureaucratic control, but the test works to give lower analytical ability scores, not higher scores, to those who would resist. Those whose political orientation leads them to comply with schemes for bureaucratic control feel at home working within systems of rules like the ones in the above questions, and typically have a lifetime of experience with such an approach to draw upon in answering this type of question. On the other hand, those whose political orientation would lead them to choose resistance as the answer to the broad problem of what to do are not likely to do their best work when restricted to the narrow problem of how to do what you are supposed to do. Yet this is the problem that serves as the official measure of analytical ability. When all else is equal, then, the test will give higher analytical ability scores to individuals whose tendency is to comply than to individuals whose tendency is to resist. The test as a whole tilts towards those who feel comfortable working within arbitrary rules, who are used to working out technical details within a dictated framework, who make their way in the world through careful attention to the rules. These individuals do not require motivation from or even knowledge of the social origin of their assigned problems. As soon as the rules are revealed, they jump right into the detail work without the mental reservations that disturb and distract others. The test favors these cooperative objects of bureaucratic control. And, as the examples above indicate, sometimes does so blatantly. We have seen that what appears to be cultural biases in selection examinations are actually political biases at root. The tests serve the interests of employers and help reproduce the present social structure by favoring individuals who are most likely to fit in well in hierarchical organizations. The test's success at doing this is cause for their abolition. Without the benefit of test scores, an educational institution's ranking of applicants would be less of a ranking by attitudes and values, and would therefore result in a more politically diverse student body. Ultimately, employers would have to contend with, and make concessions to, a segment of the workforce at the higher educational levels that is more politically diverse, and therefore less politically subordinate. And that was Chapter 11, Gratuitous Bias, from the book Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul-Battering System that Shapes Their Lives by Jeff Schmidt, published in the year 2000 by Roman N. Littlefield. If you're interested in more information about Jeff Schmidt or about this book, please visit his website at disciplinedminds.com. If you've missed previous readings from Disciplined Minds, they're all archived on the show's website, unwelcomeguests.org. Look in the show archive. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thanks for listening.
You still catch me napping one day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle will always be filled by